Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:16 p.m. Today is Friday, February 7, 2020. Members present are Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative David Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Co-Chair Garen Tarr, Vice Chair Greyer Hopkins, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. And before we get started, please silence your cell phones. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and LIO moderator, Brett Mello. There are several items on today's agenda. First, we'll hear a presentation on land ownership in Alaska from Mr. Mike Sfraga, director of the Wilson Center's Global Risk and Resilience Program and Polar Institute. Following Mr. Sfraga's presentation, the committee will resume discussion on two bills that we heard at our last meeting. And for the information of the committee, neither of the co-chair's offices received any amendments for either of these bills. With that, Mr. Sfraga, if you'll please join us at the table, introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Chair Lincoln, Co-Chair Tarr, Vice Chair Hopkins, and members of this committee. Thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I'm Mike Sfraga. I'm the director of the Wilson Center's Polar Institute and the director of our Global Risk and Resilience Program in Washington, D.C. So I would like to just spend a few minutes, and please let me know how long I have so I can go faster or slower, working through a few things. First, you should know me in the context for this presentation. So I work for the Woodrow Wilson Center. It was founded over five decades ago by Congress. So we are part of the U.S. government. We are the nation's think tank. We inform and sometimes even influence domestic and foreign policy. We are rated almost always in the top 10 think tanks in the world, in the country, and we have certain regional expertise. So we are called upon by the administration or Congress or heads of state or others to influence and inform their thinking strictly on policy issues. But today I'm here to talk to you about this new Arctic, right? The Arctic that others have said is emerging, and I have said it has emerged. And where does Alaska stand in all of this? What are our challenges? Certainly, what are our opportunities? And what are the risks out there that we should be thinking about when it comes to how we manage our own lands, our own infrastructure, our own resources? It has been interesting to do this position in Washington, D.C. as an Alaskan, because I've spent a great deal of time educating Washington, D.C., whoever I can get, whether it's on the Metro or in the Senate, on why they should care about our state and why our state should play a critical role in the nation's energy equation, security equation, on and on and on. But we're gaining some traction, mostly because Senator Sullivan, Senator Murkowski, and Representative Young have pushed that rock up that hill for a very long time. But the rest of the world has discovered the Arctic and the Arctic Ocean. It doesn't degrade the narrative when you say a new ocean is opening, because it is opening. And with that comes a potential rush to resource. The Arctic Ocean is 1.5 times the size of this country. It's half the size of the continent of Africa. It's hard to get your arms around what's happening in the Arctic, and it's happening very, very quickly. So the scale and scope of the Arctic is broadening, the importance is increasing, and our state, I think, plays a very critical role, not just for the nation, but I think connecting to the rest of the Arctic and, in fact, to the globe. And that's the work that I do in Washington, D.C. So it's emerged politically, socially, economic, you pick your phrases, we're there. We are no longer isolated. We're not off the coast of California on the weather map. We are not some mythical sci-fi movie in the 1950s. We are part of the global narrative. No matter where I go, whether it's in Tromso or Munich or Beijing, the Arctic comes up. We're now a part of the overall narrative of global politics. To characterize this, it's been a challenge to really wrap your brain around what's happening. So I came up with this framework, which I talked about yesterday. Look, it's a catch line, navigating the Arctic's seven seas. To me, there are seven primary drivers of issues in the Arctic. And these seas, you get the hook because people think it's the oceans and the seas, but it's not. In this case, it's these seas. These are the drivers. And I think Alaska plays a unique role in informing and influencing these drivers, but also taking advantage of some of these drivers. So in brief, climate, it's real, it is rapid, and it's relentless. It's happening everywhere. You would not be talking about the Arctic as much as we are if climate change wasn't a driving factor in the melt of that ice cap. There would not be the NSR, the Northern Sea Route, as important to the Russian Federation as it is now because of that pack ice declining. Don't want to argue cause and effect? Happy to do so. The fact of the matter is the Arctic pack ice is shrinking. That has made opportunities for commodities. It's increased commerce. I talk about connectivity in broad-based ways. That's internet connectivity, because as we know, our state sometimes has a digital divide. Most times we have a digital abyss. But connectivity in ports and in rails and energy, all of those things to me are a driver in the Arctic. Our communities, and we can list a long number of issues related to our communities in the Arctic. The Arctic is a zone of cooperation, but it's also a zone of potential conflict and competition. So when I talk to people about the Arctic, it's just like talking to them about climate change or things that you just can't wrap your brain around. At least these seven seas have provided buckets that we can talk about in some meaningful way and actually have informed policy. And when people think about Alaska and the Arctic, they think about this equation, Alaska and Russia. It's a good equation. We should be thinking about that. We have a lot to say about the Bering Strait. We have resources to manage. We have fisheries to manage. We also have national defense to watch. But that's not the only dynamic. It's not just Alaska and Russia. What's emerged and what we need to think about in terms of investment or our positioning on the globe is this new great power competition. Okay, is it real? Yes, it's real. Are we at war? We are not. Is there potential? Of course. Is it manageable? Yes. But I think in order for us to understand some motives by other non-Arctic states, particularly China, and I want to focus on China today a little bit, is the framework in which these countries think. And so just like the seven seas, I've come up with this board game analogy because, frankly, it's the only one I could think of, and it sort of works. And here's the board game. When China comes knocking on any country's door for investment, understand to them investment means influence. Okay? It means influence. It could be a debt trap, not all the time, sometimes, but investment means influence. Just like presence means influence, investment is influence. So China takes the long-term game. They could lose a lot of money over a lot of decades because they got a bank behind them called China. They can lose a lot of money and invest long-term. It's not the way we do business, but it's the way China does business. And if you can't pay back your debt, they're willing to take back the property they gave that loan for. But China plays the game Go. Go is this long-term strategic board game, and the object is to surround your enemy. That's the game. And when you look at what they've done from Africa to the Arctic, they've begun to play this game Go decades ago. While our country was focused elsewhere, other countries focused elsewhere, China has been investing, and they have been influencing. And they got a lot of time, they got a lot of money, a lot of energy, and they have a lot of people. And they are gaining a lot of influence globally, everywhere. So when you think about China, in any deal you make, you need to think about their game. To Mike, their game is the game Go. Long-term strategy. Top-down politics. Whatever President Xi says is likely going to happen. Not so much a democracy. In Russia, they play the game Survivor. I mean, we've got a huge country with nine time zones, 150-plus million people, a declining demographic, and the GDP of Italy. General Petraeus, who co-chairs our advisory board, says it's a gas station with nukes. Yes, maybe. I think they're a little more than that, but we get the point. Oil and gas development, mostly from the Arctic. And you see where President Putin has done there. He has invested his own resources, certainly Chinese money, a lot of Chinese money in the Northern Sea Route. They're developed the Northern Sea Route from Murmansk all the way to the Bering Coast. That's what they are doing, with tax incentives now for 10 or 15 years, 0% tax for extraction. And if a company builds a port, 0% tax. He wants to develop the Northern Sea Route because 20% of their GDP, they say, I think it's a lot more, comes from the Arctic somehow. And more than 30% of their exports come from the Arctic somehow. So that's their route to the future. It goes through their Arctic, which is resource-rich, like our Arctic is resource-rich. But they're willing to put the investment in, and they're willing to take direct foreign investment from China and other nations to do so. So their deal is Survivor. President Putin wants to be relevant, and he wants to be respected. President Xi wants to run the table. The United States plays the game Twister, in my opinion. That is not a pejorative statement. When you think about what we are as a global power, we've got one hand in the South China Sea, one in the Pacific, one, you name it. We are everywhere. And sometimes we get distracted, but we are everywhere. And so our frame of reference is we have to influence by investment, by power, by security, by the rule of law. China, not so much by the rule of law. Not so much. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But those three games, to me, provide a good analogy as to how these countries think. We think as a global superpower, as we should. Russia's just trying to hang in there. Just want to be relevant with big nukes. And China says, great, I'll outplay you all because now I can. That's really important for any small country that wants to develop a port or a state like ours that might entertain Chinese investment. Just understand the framework from which they come and the sophistication China has. They are an observer to the Arctic Council. These are eight Arctic nations who came together 2 decades ago to work through mostly environmental issues related to the Arctic, not all. These are consensus-driven organizations. This is a consensus-driven organization. They have binding agreements, everything from search and rescue, which is fantastic because the tyranny of distance in the Arctic is brutal. So our Arctic Coast Guards work together a lot. There is interoperability between the Coast Guards. Lots of discussions on Bering Strait agreements as to how we monitor traffic. That's a fantastic thing. The U.S. and Russia gave that to the U.N. The U.N. passed it through the IMO. That's good cooperation. China does not negotiate. They inform and influence the game board. So they would like to be an observer to the Arctic Council. Now they are an observer to the Arctic Council. Do they have a vote? No. But they're there. They are in the room. They're participating. Very good, not nefarious, in research and other things. But they simply can influence dialogue in the Arctic Council in some manner. And by positioning themselves within the Arctic Council as an observer, it's not all nefarious. But there is an influencing mechanism, and if you see what they've done elsewhere in the world, they have joined or been observers to other like organizations. So it's not just one thing. You have to view it as a progression of a strategy, overall global strategy. But having China as part of the Arctic Council is good because they actually do really good, viable research. This photo to me, this montage, really sums it up. So we have the President of China and the Prime Minister of Norway. They've invested in Arctic nations, Iceland, Norway, Greenland, Finland, Sweden, you name the country, they've invested in them. The handshake is not so much the big deal here, and China has invested in Norway. They've invested in infrastructure and other things, but the map is so telling. When China just a few years ago released their white paper, their Arctic strategy, they provided to all of us their perspective of the Arctic. Now, I said this yesterday, I'll say it again, I looked at my degrees. I am a geographer by training. I see maps all the time. China has proclaimed themselves a near Arctic state. They are not a near Arctic state. But when you take China on a map and you flip it like they did in this image, our orientation is north-south. It appears that, well, maybe they got a point. Maybe they are a near Arctic state. Well, no, not really, if I tilt my head. But you see, the messaging is really interesting. And the connections that they see for them in the Inner Kingdom, everything back to the Inner Kingdom. So it's really interesting when you read their narratives, how they situate even their models of how they perceive the Arctic to be. And of course, the big driver for China in the Arctic are the resources. $20 to $25 billion of the Yamal Peninsula development of the Sabeda plant has come from direct foreign investment from China, with others as well. But China's more than willing to invest because they get a percent of that LNG. Do they need the LNG? Yes, but they can get it elsewhere cheaper, and they are. This is simply yet another way to get a diversified portfolio of resources. Without Chinese money, Russia cannot develop the Sabeda plant and other plants along the Northern Sea Route. The Northern Sea Route will never rival the Panama Canal and the Suez, but it is a viable, quicker way to move some products to places that would take longer before. There was a tour, there was a cruise, 13 days from the Sabeda plant to ports in China of Russian LNG. 13 days. If I'm a shipper, I like that number a lot because every day I'm not in the water, I'm making money. So that's a viable seaway for some things that we should be cognizant of. This depicts the difference in that sea route. It will never, again, rival the Suez and the Panama, but it gives us some perspective. They also fully realize that Russia provides for them support in this very area. This is how they see the world. The Polar Silk Road, from the Cepeda plant all the way down to markets in Asia, that's just part of the larger Belt and Road Initiative. And again, investment means influence. So the Arctic is part of their much broader strategy here to connect their Belt and Road system. These are highways, infrastructure, ports, rail, oil and pipelines, gas pipelines. This is how they see the world, and our Arctic is part of that world. Their investments are known, of course, worldwide, but about 25% of their investments abroad are in the countries of Africa. And this is just growing day by day. So it's everything from building three-lane highways through national parks to building ports, and these are all loans. And the money better be there to pay back that loan. And there have been a few cases where there's been that debt trap, where they actually have been given back, like in Sri Lanka, the port there. But the issue here is, look at what's happening. You have influence by investment. So if a nation is in debt to China, like half of a continent, you might be swayed one way or the other as to how you might vote in the UN. You might be swayed as to whether or not you take the next investment. You might be swayed as to how much of your resource you give to a certain country. It's about influence. Here we see that I only have a couple of slides left, just a couple of examples of connecting the Arctic to Russia and China. This is a real route invested by multiple investors, but significant Chinese money, of a cargo connection coming out of Finland all the way to ports across China. I mean, that is a significant connection, and that's what's happening everywhere in the world. Here's their vision. They would like to see more of these connections and rail and tunnel under the Baltics. So this is far more than just small investments or wanting to influence things on a small scale. We see this across the Scandinavian countries, European countries, African countries, Caribbean countries, South Pacific, elsewhere. This is from my colleagues at CNS. This is about a year and a half old, but you get the idea. You get the idea that they are willing to invest in a lot of places, including the Arctic, where perhaps as much as 12% of the Greenlandic GDP could be linked to Chinese investment. Not all of that money is sitting there, but if China were allowed to build the ports they'd like to build, the airports they'd like to build in Greenland, a small little country of 57,000 people, overruled by Kingdom of Denmark, you could have significant sway in small countries, even big countries, by the investments made. So it's not just in big countries like Canada and the United States. It's in smaller Arctic countries as well, like in Iceland, where there is significant investment in Iceland, mostly in their ports. Almost finally, they really do want to be a global power when it comes to the Arctic and the Antarctic. They're building a nuclear icebreaker. They have the capacity to build icebreakers in China. They don't have to buy them from the Ukraine like they've done before. They can build their own. So their aspirations are in Africa, to the Arctic, to the Antarctic, in every part of our globe. So I go back to this, which is the last slide. Whenever we're thinking about land ownership, pipelines, who buys our agricultural land, who lends us money, who might lend us money, we should just be, in my opinion, a bit careful about the larger geopolitical play here and where these countries come from, who would like to maybe give us money, loan us money, to develop our resources. It's just a precautionary tale. As someone, one of my colleagues told me, the best way to deal with China is to find the best negotiators and then ask those best negotiators who is better than they are, and then go get them. And that's really a telling statement. Go get them. Just because of what's happening around the world. Mm-hmm. And again, not all of their investments are nefarious. We just need to understand that places like Alaska and Iceland and Finland are just smaller parts of a much bigger play for China. So with that, I'm happy to take some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sprager. We do have some questions from committee members, and first I want to recognize that Rep. Sponholz joined us at about 1:18, and Rep. Sponholz has a question.
Thank you, Dr. Sprager. We saw, a larger version of this presentation in the Joint Armed Services Committee yesterday. And in this afternoon's presentation, you said something that caught my attention, particularly, I think this was very useful context for us as we understand Alaska's position in sort of the global the global environment. And reflecting back on the gas line proposal that the previous governor had, which proposed major investment from China, when you said that China has a history of investing in assets and then taking back those assets, that really caught my attention. And I was wondering if you could give us an example or two of that.
So in anticipation that I might be asked something like that, I went back and took a hard look at some of these. And, you know, the debt trap, it's a real thing. The one palpable, striking example is the port in Sri Lanka, where the small little country in Sri Lanka took about a big loan to develop their port and then did not have the revenue they thought. It was a build it and they will come. Well, they built it and they didn't come. Right. They had no market, on and on. So in a negotiation, Sri Lanka went back to the Chinese government and said, we absolutely can't pay for this anymore, so why don't you just kind of take it back and run it for us? And the Chinese said, we can run that for you. But running it also means we get to say which ships come in, what goes out, what freight comes in. And so now, I don't know that it was a plan of China. We're not quite sure. But, you know, China can look at books the same way we can look at books. And they can see a country's balance sheet. And they can do the numbers better than most countries. So when you think about that, those of us who watch this think there are some places where the investment is real. There are other places where the opportunity cost to them is really low because the possibility that this country might default is a little higher than others. Sri Lanka is one of those cases that we often look at, is that this never really made sense in a lot of different ways. And so this might have been one, although it will never be quoted overtly, that the economics just wasn't going to work. And so the cautionary tale, even to countries in Africa, and who a lot of these countries exactly don't stick to the rule of law. I mean, there is a reason China is in different places influencing different things. But the precautionary tale with Sri Lanka is that for 99 years, they will have almost no say over their major port. Who comes, who goes, what's shipped, what's not. I mean, that is an unbelievable thing. And then think of where Sri Lanka is. China is in the South China Sea. They have claimed territory that the U.S. and other international courts have said they're not entitled to. Yet they took those coral reefs, built islands on them, now they're military reinforced. That's a way to close off a choke point from the United States and have more influence. Sri Lanka is really, really strategic. Now they have a strategic port in Sri Lanka. So that is one palpable example of how we need to be really careful, we, the collective we, in how we invest, who we invest with, who we take money from, and making sure that you find those really good people and then ask them who's better than they are and go get them. But there are other things that are working just fine, but they simply have the money to do it. For instance, they've opened, you know, a huge Power of Siberia pipeline between Russia and China, in addition to the Northern Sea Route, in addition to all those things. They run a pipeline cross-border. Now, President Putin likes that because that's cash. The Chinese like it because they're getting LNG. But that will work to China's advantage more, it will work to the Russian advantage. But at least he's got money. President Putin has money coming in at a time when Western sanctions are crippling that country. But the balance sheets kind of work for the Russian Federation. They kind of work for China. And there's an agreement that's fairly solid that they'd be happy. I wouldn't be happy with it, but they would be happy with it. But for our state, is do we, whomever it is, country X, do we allow them to lend us money to build our pipeline? And then how do we pay them back? Or is it a percent of LNG? Is it cash? What is that? And that's the complexities. But understand, and it may be a wonderful deal, but it just needs to be in the context of what they're doing elsewhere. That was a long response to a very short question. I apologize.
Coach Yatar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I swear, every time I hear you present, I'm like, I wish I had hours more because it's so fascinating to me. And I wanted to apologize to committee members because partly what spurred this presentation was hearing about some interest in foreign interest in agricultural lands in Alaska. And we had the research do a legislative research report on this topic that we'll share with members. Mm-hmm. And I just apologize that I just forgot to have that here. But we had seen Dr. Sraga speak at the Defense Forum this fall and was talking about this, and then just had a conversation. And Director Shady didn't mention it, but he has been contacted with some proposals about foreign investment in our agricultural lands. And so when you see that map of Africa, you know, you think, okay, we're a low-cost place to invest. You know, our land cost is pretty low relative to other places. And if you've got a long-term plan, right, and you're looking at feeding a 1.3 billion person country. And the one thing you didn't say today that you said yesterday is that their middle class is bigger than our whole country. Yeah. And that really put it in perspective for me. But we'll share that report. And I just think it is an issue we kind of, you know, could fly under the radar and we may completely miss in a way that could be really problematic down the road on the land ownership. But I'm really happy to hear the answer you had about the pipeline, because, you know, on those big issues for us, I'm certainly no expert and I'm just trying to learn and learn and learn. And I think you've really, you know, as we evaluate any of the opportunities going forward, have given us a much different perspective about our role in the geopolitical sphere, you know, to evaluate. And I think that will be very helpful and more, you know, foundational knowledge for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Bannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I actually have a question about icebreakers, but before we leave the China influence, when I always, in my Alaska history classes, would remind people that China has been involved and engaged in Alaska's economy since the beginning of expansion of the Russians. It's what brought Russians to come here to harvest sea otters was the Chinese market for that fur. So in the long range frame in the Chinese history, that's just one chapter back. And they've always viewed us as an asset for economic growth. The U.S. only has two icebreakers currently, six in plans. Where are those in the plans? When are we going to see another icebreaker?
In my opinion, not soon enough, but there's some progress being made. So there's money in the budget to build the first of the six proposed. That's in process right now. That might come online, pick a number, 3-5 years down the road, but it could be the one that replaces our heavy icebreaker that's down in the Antarctic, because that thing's being held. I mean, Alaskans would have a feast on that because it's duct tape and baling wire, and it's what we do for a living up here. That's what's keeping that icebreaker afloat. I mean, it literally has caught fire the last two seasons, mid-expedition. So that heavy icebreaker is just on its last legs. Our other icebreakers cannibalized, the one that's in dry dock, to fix that one. They have been looking on eBay for parts at some points. So we'll have maybe a plus-up of nothing. It might be just a mid, the Healy, and a heavy. That's in process right now. Many of us have testified to Congress that we should be building these in packages. So instead of just one, we should actually bulk these, right? But you're talking about $900 million per. And I think the comeback is that, you know, it's all about volume, volume, volume. But we've had to build our capacity to build an icebreaker. That's why the flag goes up or down for any of us when we realize that China can actually, they actually can do it now. And so if China can do it, why can't this country stand up an entire complex on icebreakers? We need them because as investment is influence, right, presence is influence. And so that's one thing. The second thing to answer is that a lot of this has been politics. These icebreakers have been on the docket for a very long time, but the head of the Coast Guard was brilliant and stopped calling these things icebreakers. We're now going to call these polar security cutters. And once you put the word security in, magically, there's a different narrative there. It's a real narrative. It's a right narrative. But it's not just all about security. It's about our fishermen in the Arctic. It's about cruise lines. If a cruise ship gets in trouble off the coast of Barrow, we're in trouble. You know, I don't know how many beds are in the hospital in Barrow, 20, 30 beds, maybe, I don't know. It's not enough for 3,000 people on a Crystal Serenity. So security I will take in the broader sense, but those are in process. One is in process, but it's simply not going to be quick enough because these other countries are building them. They have capacity. It's not just Russia. It's Finland and Norway and Sweden and Japan and China. Japan is now crafting another icebreaker as well.
One follow-up. So we have no functional icebreakers in the Arctic today.
We have one, and that's the Healy, But that Healy is mostly a research vessel. It supports research. but it's not docked. It's not present in the Arctic. It's not docked in the Arctic, right? It's stationed not in the Arctic. So, you know, our wonderful Coast Guard in Kodiak will have to respond to anything anywhere in our Arctic, and they simply don't have the capacity. And I don't offhandedly say this and with trepidation, but we can get a plane or a helicopter to the North Slope just in time to watch not good things happen. We need to have a presence. And Senator Sullivan asked me in a testimony in December, how many of our Coast Guard cutters should be stationed in Alaska? And I said two, stationed in Alaska. Stationed, not roving in the summer.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Yesterday, thank you for your presentation. I did mention this in yesterday's JASC meeting, but I think that the resources should hear this too. So when we talk about those two icebreakers, there's really only one, as was mentioned, because the other one's just parts for the other. And it's not up here. It's always used down in the Antarctica. So I do have a resolution already prepared, ready to drop in, and it is to name the next icebreaker, or if we want to call it the polar security cutter, the polar bear. One, because it's recognizing the longest cutter ship that we had in U.S. Coast Guard service was the bear, which is hanging up on my wall. I got a picture of it hanging up on my wall in my office. And second, there are no polar bears in the South Pole, so we can keep it up here for the Arctic. So I just want to mention it. I'll drop that in real soon.
Nano.
Yeah, I might offer an amendment to change it to the Nano.
We don't want that drifting down south.
Do we have any other questions from the committee? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Mike. Welcome
nice
to town.
See you.
The Mosaic experiment, the research vessel that they've embedded in the Arctic ice and is floating for, I think, a year. You didn't talk a lot about research that's happening up there and the international partnerships that's happening up there. Can you talk a little bit about the data that's going to be driving and the notoriety that we do have up there and how we're partnering or not with China and Russia and Norway and other Arctic countries up there on the slope?
Yeah, it's great. Thank you for the question. That's the cooperation slide I really didn't go into. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the one, that's a really bright spot, is that the research that happens in the Arctic really is international. And that's based on decades of personal relationships with scientists, but the scientific community understands full well that we don't understand full well. I mean, the Arctic Ocean is still a mystery to us after all of these years and all of the research. Mosaic is stationed there and will float with the pack ice to do a number of things. It'll measure ice thickness, extent, plastics. Plastics are all over the globe. They're in our Arctic ice pack. They're in the food chain. Ocean acidification, methane leaks, CO2. It is a broad-based, multi-month expedition. It's sort of like, to use these phrases, but it's like a Manhattan Project for the ice cap. It really is to try to understand what is happening. And that's everything from the albedo, the sun, the reflection of the sun off the ice, and perhaps more importantly, the absorption of the solar radiation into a ever-darkening ocean, which just is called a positive feedback loop, but it's negative to all of us because it just keeps the water getting warmer and warmer. But that, you're right, that's a multiple number of nations all coordinating their science all over the course of a year. My sense is that this will be one of yearly efforts on behalf of the scientific community. It comes in the backdrop of not just researchers doing independent researches, but countries trying to coordinate this research nationally and internationally, because that's what this is really about. Everyone has realized this is too complicated, what's happening around the globe. We got to kind of join forces and resources. But it comes in the backdrop of the first international Arctic science ministerial held a number of years ago when the United States chaired the Arctic Council. There was a science ministerial then. And these were Arctic and non-Arctic nations. You know, Germany, for instance, and Japan, big powerhouses in research, trying to figure out what it is that they do, how they could apply it to future research. There was a second one just a year or so ago in Berlin. There'll be a third ministerial in Tokyo in November. So these things now are part of the play, international community focusing on the Arctic. And I think you're going to see more and more of these large-scale coordinated research efforts globally, almost like the International Polar Year, the IPYs, where the scientific community from around the globe came together to look at a common interest or a number of common scientific questions. I think the Arctic Ocean is just one place where you'll see far more of that. And we work with the Chinese and the Russians and others all the time in this area. And that's the good side of the Arctic. And that's what many of us would like to see leveraged for other big geopolitical issues as well.
No, he answered it right at the end.
Okay. Kutcher Tar?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize in that earlier statement because I didn't give you an opportunity to just give any thoughts you have on that issue of foreign, you know, foreign agriculture, foreign land ownership in Alaska, and more specifically. And so you are much more the expert. If you have any thoughts to share, please.
I think they just, thank you for the question. I think they just go along the lines of the precautionary tale. When you look at, for instance, China has leased land across the border into Russia for agricultural development. And it was pitched as not only bringing that food product to China, but also as an economic development for the communities right on the border. Not so much. I mean, they really haven't seen the value coming out. It's almost like a, it will pay you to do the job, but there's no multiplier effect for our communities. And so if you scale that out, it's going to be the same thing. You see it in Africa. Any arable land, water rights, all of those issues need to be looked at. So, and I think the underlying question is why? Why would China or any other country want to buy Alaskan agricultural land? Why would that be? Because it's probably more productive land someplace else cheaper. I don't know, but it seems an interesting question to ask. And the other one is to think about dual use. In Iceland, they opened up a multi-million dollar research facility in Iceland. And it's a great research facility, but people are questioning the capacity of their satellites and data systems, and could that be used for other activities, like monitoring of air forces, because that's not too far from Keflavik Air Force Base. So the question always has been, again, not all of their investments are nefarious, but the question I would ask if I were sitting across from a negotiator from China about buying my agricultural land is, why do you want to buy my agricultural land? What is that? Is it to provide influence, workforce? What is that all about? So, again, not all are nefarious, but it goes in line with everything else. That's why I started with the big game board. How does this fit into the bigger game board?
Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for bringing that up. You know, you have to ask why. I have, after this meeting, if you don't mind, when I get a chance, I would like to show you some pictures of some facilities, some equipment that China has in Nome through the university. And so they are making grants, donations to the university in exchange for allowing them to have, they say it's weather monitoring. Mm-hmm. Who knows really what it is. It's definitely transmission. And so I've always had a little bit of concern. I'm not paranoid, but I like being aware of what's going on. And it was presented to me, and then I presented on others. Mm-hmm. And so, but I'd like to have you take a look at it as well, just to see, because I mean, why do they have to do that here? Why do they want it here? And you look at Nome, you look how close we are, and watching everything that's going in and out. We're talking about maybe a deep water port there in Nome. Because of its strategic location. So, yeah, thank you for sharing.
Do that.
Any other questions from the committee?
Photographs on my phone.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say how much I appreciate the presentation tonight.
Thank you.
I know you were familiar with the process we were going through. I'm sure as we, there was, I guess what we were told in negotiation with China as we were working our way through the LNG project. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you would share the same opinion as I believe Representative Tar and I came up with. We were presented with these agreements that we had seen on several occasions. And those appeared to be letters of interest to me, not necessarily solid agreements. Mm-hmm. And it just appeared to me at the end of all of those, the question that was implied but was missing is, what else do you have to offer? Mm-hmm. With a big question mark on those. Would you say that was kind of a fair assessment of where China was headed with their negotiations with the state of Alaska?
Great question. I think so. Those were letters of intent. We will negotiate to negotiate. And that's a good thing. That's standard. Mm-hmm. But that's where I start slipping in the motive and how what are the details now? That's why I go find a really smart person and ask them who's smarter. And the letters of intent follow this standard. That's the way they have done business. It's fine. But it doesn't mean that they've signed up for anything. And as you go down that path, expect that you will be asked for more and more and more. It might be worth it. The value equation might be on our side to do that. It might be. But it just needs to be investigated and time taken to work through those. But my read of those were the same. Those were letters of intent to begin negotiations. And if negotiations start up again, that's a fine thing. Just it's our land and it's our resource, and we get to say it. Mike's perspective, we get to say at the last minute whether or not we want to do this. Is it really in our best interest? And let's show me the numbers. Give me the value equation.
Thank you. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. I think just to comment on the gas line piece, I think, you know, that what we've seen in China's efforts across the world, but particularly in Africa, is that they have very advantageously negotiated in the best interests of China, where they have negotiated to have control over a resource, extract the resource, and in doing so use largely only Chinese employees in the process, so that there's as little benefit that goes to the local community from which they are extracting a resource as possible. And when I think about the history of our state, the history of our state has, I think, in many respects, been that of almost a banana republic for resource extraction. And when I think about where we want to go moving forward, we want to make sure that any agreements that we're setting up are in the absolute best interest of Alaskans, that are employing Alaskans and leaving as much of the resource in Alaska and in the United States, so that we can be, you know, strengthening our sort of geopolitical position, as well as our economy and our workforce here. But one of the things that you talked about yesterday, and Jask, that you didn't discuss here today that I think is of interest, was the large, the huge amount of development that the Russians have done on the, you know, on the northern part of their country in terms of setting up ports and military bases and other infrastructure. And I don't remember if there, you didn't have the, yesterday you had a slide that showed the infrastructure that Russia has put up on its North Slope, which was just mind-blowing in comparison to our utter lack of resourcing in Canada and the North Slope of Alaska. And wonder if you want to comment a little bit about ports and, you know, other assets that we should be thinking about strategically in building in Alaska.
Thank you. So again, the Russian Federation, their future goes through the Arctic. President Putin says this in meetings and on television. They have developed the Sepeda port on the Yamal Peninsula for LNG. That's a $40, $50 billion complex. It looks a lot like our North Slope, right? It's got LNG. It's got what? Now they're building petrochemical plants. So polypropylene, pick your favorite poly, they're developing them with tax incentives. So it's gone beyond LNG and gas. The Yamal Peninsula has the Sepeda plant, but there's going to be Sepeda 2 and 3. These are large-scale, and I'm sorry I don't have the photo here, large-scale complexes on their Arctic slope built with Chinese money. But it's not the only one. Now new tax incentives are set in place so that you will see complexes from Murmansk all the way east to the Bering. And these are ports. These are, I call it the Russian sandwich. It's a bad analogy. I'll figure out one on a run some night. But it's a better one. But when you look at the north slope of the Northern Sea Route of Russia, you will see ports, cities, oil and gas development. You will see military assets that are mirrored over those ports, just like any normal leader should and would do. Then the Northern Sea Route, the shipping lane you see there in red, destinational within Russia, because they have nickel mines, they're serving their own communities. That's how they've been for decades, serving their own country. You know, if you look at that slide and hang a left, you can go to Rotterdam in Europe. You hang a right, you can go to down the Bering Strait and to markets in Asia in up, you know, as quickly as 13 days. But every one of those squares you see there is a new or renovated Soviet era or brand new Russian Federation military complex. So you have an overlay. You have the Russian landscape, their north slope, oil and gas development, and communities, strategic. Then you have the shipping lanes, which they have been using for decades. That's why there's 50-plus icebreakers, because it's their lifeline to the big rivers and communities. It's also a future growing international trade route, the Northern Sea Route. Above that, you see those little squares. So from Franz Josef Land, just a stone's throw to Svalbard and a little more to Greenland, but all the way to Wrangel Island, our neighborhood, there are Russian facilities that they say are for radar and good safety, and it could be for all search and rescue. But nonetheless, these are Russian air bases with radar capacity, communications capacity to not only, yes, enhance search and rescue, but it really is to defend what they seem to be their future lifeline. So this is not going to stop. We are all in here. And this is investments from oligarchs, investments from Russia, and investments from China, and frankly, Total, the French oil company, the Japanese. So he has created an international marketplace for oil and gas development in the Russian North. And that's just what the market will bear. And so he's willing to take the resources because of these crippling sanctions, and they've moved on. And by the way, this is an unholy alliance here. These are not two countries that really get along all that well, but they are tolerating each other because they have mutual interests and a common enemy, right? A common foe, us. China is the number two economy. They will be the number one sometime. So there's a common us. So whether it's the South China Sea, the Northern Sea Route, or activities in the North, or you pick it, there's the common us. So the two have a marriage of convenience. And right now it fuels the Russian economy. So that's why you see this massive buildup. My sense is you'll have a lot more of it.
Any other questions from the committee? That was a very interesting presentation. Thank you very much, Dr. Sraga.
I appreciate it.
We will now move on to the next item on today's agenda, which is House Bill 197, extending the Seismic Hazard Safety Commission. As I mentioned earlier, we received no amendments to this bill. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Any questions from committee members? Ready to make a motion? Representative Tuck?
I just want to point out that we do have a recommendation letter from State Farm, and we also have one coming from the Professional Design Council here soon, but it's not here yet. But okay. We are getting some recommendation letters for it.
Got more support?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move that House Bill 197, version 31-LS1357, /A, move from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, HB 197, work draft version 31-LS1357/A, moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And we will go ahead and take a brief at ease to sign that. This is House Bill 230, Intensive Management Surcharge Repeal Termination Date. Again, we received no amendments for this bill. I would like to note for members that we received a few new documents, letters of support from the Resident Hunters of Alaska and the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and also a document that you should all have. It's a pie chart showing the distribution of spending in FY19. That was in response to a question from Representative Hopkins. Director Grasser with the Wildlife Conservation Unit and Department of Fish and Game is available online for questions, as is Cheryl Brooking with Department of Law. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Hopkins?
Thank you. And this one's just a question for Director Grasser. The pie chart shows just 1% of the $3.4 million that goes into that's being brought in from these surcharges, and the 1% on the predator control. I was wondering if you could talk about what that 1% is being spent on this year, and also if that fluctuates year to year, and what the high water mark is, at least in your recent memory. I don't need backup on that. Just wondering what that might be in your recent memory, and what those programs involved as well.
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins. Well, my history is not very long since I just started this job a year ago, but the reason that the predator management figures are not very high is because most of our effort goes into what's called survey and inventory, because we need to know what numbers are out there and whatever species we're talking about, moose, caribou, or deer. And that's how we find out what our harvestable surplus is. So, in some cases, in some game management units, we're also using private citizens to help us with predator prey management programs, which reduces the department's cost. So, as far as I know, I think the 1% is probably fairly accurate in most years. But we can research that further and get those numbers to you.
Thank you. And quick follow up. You said the survey and inventory under survey and inventory is where most of your money is spent, and I'm assuming that's on the research and management side?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, yes, sir.
And then one more quick follow-up. The you said some areas are using resident hunters, and I was wondering what areas are currently using resident hunters and on that predator management or predator control?
Through the chair, Representative Hawkins, there's a resident pilot hunters in game management unit 13, 20, and I believe in 19 that we utilize.
Thank you.
And just want to point out for members too that we have a map that should be distributed also that shows the unit areas.
No, sorry, one more follow-up.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Are there any?
Plenty of time. So
all right, cool. Are there any out-of-state hunters participating currently in any of those predator control programs?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, not to my knowledge, but that's a question I'll have to ask staff. Unfortunately, I'm at the Western Directors Forum in Reno right now, and so I don't have everything with me.
Not a problem. I appreciate you calling in.
Mr. Rauscher?
Yeah. Thank you, through the chair. I had ran into Mr. Mage from the forestry in the hallway, and I asked him the question that I asked the other day, which was once they've identified an area for a prescribed burn, where the costs, how it gets differentiated, and basically his I'm glad Mr. Grasser is here. He might be able to confirm this, but anyway, he basically said that the IM program would make a request, and they've got terminology for the request, which I'm not going to repeat because I'd get it wrong. But anyway, so they'd make a request to the state. State would look at it. I mean, the forestry would look into it. They would agree, but the monies would come from Pittman Robertson funds. So I just thought that might be something that everybody wants to know, but they make a request for the monies from the Pittman Robertson funding, and that is how those are taken care of. So I just thought I'd let you all know that.
Representative, Mr. Grasser, did you hear the comment from Representative Rauscher?
Mr. Chair, yes, I did, and it's not all Pittman Robertson funds because we have to have a 1-3 match to get those funds, so it's still some IM money that goes into that.
Thank you.
So just to be clear, that your program cooperates with the forestry program for controlled burns that simultaneously provides fire breaks to protect Alaskan structures and land, and also provides better habitat for game populations that are under IM?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And when you're talking about game populations where a prescribed burn takes place, it's not just game animals that people hunt for food. It's all kinds of game, like songbirds, game birds like ptarmigan or rough grouse, and arctic hare, or snowshoe hare. So there's lots of animals affected in a positive way by prescribed burns.
Okay. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing no further questions, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 230, working draft version 31-LS1460/A from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Are there any objections? Okay. Seeing none, House Bill 230, work draft version 31-LS1460/A moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Please stay after the meeting to sign the committee report. Our next meeting will be Monday, February 10, where we will hear an introduction on the committee substitute for House Bill 138, the National Resource Water Designation, otherwise known as Tier 3. Thank the committee for a very good meeting today. I hope you all have a good weekend.